This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
What I'm going to deal with is basically the parsha of the Meraglim, the spies that were sent into Israel by Moshe, the 12 spies that were sent this morning said this. We know the result of the episode was that not only they, but the entire Jewish people who had left Egypt were not to be permitted to enter Eretz Israel. Now, to understand the severity of that, you must see the entering of Eretz Israel as the absolute goal of each and every Jew that came out of Egypt. There was no point of going into a desert if they thought they were never going to get out of the desert. The thing they were striving towards, the thing that they were really battling to achieve, the height of their fulfillment, was going to be finally reaching Eretz Israel. And the punishment of not reaching Eretz Israel would be comparable to a situation which you can imagine with yourselves. Imagine that you did have a clear goal. Part of a lot of our troubles is that we don't have a clear goal. We don't know where we're really trying to reach. But imagine if you did know exactly where you were trying to reach, and overnight somebody came and made it impossible for you ever to reach there. It raises a question of meaninglessness in your whole existence all of a sudden. The whole goal and purpose for which you're striving, you're told that you can't ever get there, forget it. So a man's trying to build up a business and is told, forget it, you'll never get there. Another man's at university trying to qualify is told, you'll never get there, forget it, don't even try. It's one of the most painful punishments that there can be. This was meted out to the 600,000 people. Now, how is it possible that 12 outstanding Jews... Sorry, I need the Medrash Rabbah as well. Those two, there's behind David. One of those two volumes there. How is it possible that 12 men of the stature of these 12, and we'll discuss in a moment exactly what stature they had, set off for the purpose of the mitzvah? The Ribbono Shalom says, Shalach lecha anashim, you must now send people. Thanks. We are to read Eretz Canaan, and they must spy out the land of Canaan. So it's a tzivui of the Ribbono Shalom. God says that they must go. They're going off on an outstanding mitzvah. How is it possible that a person can set off doing a mitzvah, a person of substance, a person of outstanding stature, can set off to do such a mitzvah, and it can land up turning up into something so severe that not only they, but 600,000 people are deprived of their life's ambitions as a result of something going wrong in that mitzvah? We have a principle that shluchei mitzvah ena nizokin, that if one does a mitzvah, if you're out to do a mitzvah, you don't get damaged on the way, you don't get harmed on the way. That doesn't apply only to physical harm, it applies to spiritual harm as well. If you're out doing a mitzvah, the mitzvah protects you from doing it wrong also, provided your intentions are straight, provided you're really doing it for the right reasons and you're going about it with the right frame of mind, then there's nothing that should or could go wrong in your performing of that mitzvah. So here you've got 12 of the most outstanding people of Am Yisrael who set out to do a mitzvah, so we must assume they set out to do it properly. If they set out to do it properly, how is it possible that they could turn it so bad and so wrong that something so terrible as the depriving of a goal for 600,000 people results from it? So we must assume, in fact, that there was something not quite right in the mitzvah itself. Right at the very beginning, ab initio, there must have been something wrong. Because if they went about it right from the beginning, if that first step was right, there's no way the Ribbono Shel'olam would bring such a calamity to them and to Klal Yisrael. We have a principle that Habalatai, Messiah Noso, if a person comes to purify himself, if he comes to do something which is correct, the Ribbono Shel'olam helps him. That's how one gets Siyata Dishmaya, that's how you get help from the Ribbono Shel'olam. We have the principle of you open a little opening like the hole of a needle and I'll open it up into doorways, into halls. So that we have the principle of Siyata Dishmaya. As long as we take an action and the action is pure, it's with the right intent, God does the rest. So we must assume that the initial action was in some way not quite right. And that ties in with further on in the Sedra, in Pasuk Kavav, where the Torah says, Vayelchu Vayavol. And they went and they came, El Moshe Ve'el Aaron, Ve'el Kol Adat B'nei Yisrael. They went and they came back to Moshe and Aaron and the whole the congregation of Israel, and the Gemara in Sotah, Daf Lamed Hei Amud Aleph, asks, what does it mean they went and they came? We know that they went already. All it has to tell us is that they came back. We're told many sentences before that they went. And the Gemara answers in the name of Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, Vayechu Vayavo Makish Halicha Lebiya. The Torah connects the state of mind in which they went to the state of mind in which they returned. Now we don't know what state of mind they went in, but we know what state of mind they returned in. As the Gemara, Ma Biyo Beitzara, in the same way as they return was with bad intent, Af Halicha Beitzara, so their going was with bad intent. That's a very bold statement of the Gemara, that these 12 men left and went on their mission of spying already with intent to do mischief. This also ties in with the Medrash that we have, of which Rashi quotes part. Ask the Medrash, what's the connection between the last story of the previous Sedra and the beginning of this Sedra? Last week's Sedra ended off with Miriam talking Lashon Hara about Moshe, and she was punished with tzaraat, with this skin disease. And this Sedra opens up with the story of the Meraglim. Answers the Medrash Ela Shehaya Tzafui Lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu Sheyomru Lashon Hara Al Haaretz. The Ribbono Shelam knew already at this stage that they were going to talk Lashon Hara about the land of Israel. Omer HaKadosh Baruch Hu Shelo Yu'omrim Lo Ayinu Yodim Onesh Lashon Hara, so that they should not be able to say we didn't know how serious it was to talk Lashon Hara. L'fichach Samach HaKadosh Baruch Hu Ha'inyan Zeh L'Zeh. That's why God put the two close together. L'fichach Dibro Miriam Ba'achel V'lakta B'tzaraat. Miriam talked about her brother and she was punished with tzaraat. Kadeshi yedu hakol onsho she loshon hara, so that everybody should know the results and consequences of talking loshon hara. She imbikshu loyma loshon hara, because if they want to talk loshon hara, if they want to denigrate Eretz Yisrael, yiyu mistakli ma naaset le Miriam. Then they should have an opportunity to look what happened to Miriam and maybe to stop themselves. Now this is very strange. Here again we see that there was a certain inevitability in them talking loshon hara. Number one, we see from the Gemara that they went out with an intent to talk evil, which is difficult to understand. They were the 12 most outstanding people of 12 of the most outstanding people of Israel. That they should have gone on a holy mission like this with intent to turn it to evil is altogether very difficult to understand. And here one sees the Medrash, where the Medrash says that the Ribbono Shel wanted to give them every opportunity not to talk Lashon Hara about the land, because he knew that there would be a tendency to talk it. He knew that there would be a strong drive to make them talk Lashon Hara about the land of Israel, and he wanted to give them sufficient ammunition to equip themselves to stop themselves from talking that Lashon Hara. It's also very strange. Why is it so inevitable? Why the Ribbono Shel Olam knows they're going to talk Lashon Hara? Why does he know? So send other people. Not only send other people, but these people were handpicked by God himself, because the previous Medrash says the following. Mikael, we can prove from here, Shayu Tzadikim Bifnei Yisrael Uvifnei Moshe, that these people were tzaddikim in the eyes of Yisrael and in the eyes of Moshe. Imagine what tzaddikim, not only did society find them righteous, but even Moshe found them righteous people. And even then, Moshe didn't want to send them on his own authority. He wanted to check with the Ribbono Shel Olam about the suitability of each one of these 12 spies. Ploni Mishevet Ploni, that's why it lists all their names. So-and-so from the tribe of so-and-so, the Omale Ruyim Haim, and for each one the Ribbono Shel Olam said, yes, he's a good man. And so on it goes, proving it. So these people are handpicked by the Ribbono Shel Olam. That means the best people God can find are still going to have a tendency to talk Lashon Hara. What is it? We go to Israel and we come back and we rave about it, how wonderful it was, and how we want to go and live there, and how everything was so fantastic. It's very seldom that you hear somebody coming back and saying something bad about the country. And here the 12 tzaddikim are going off and says, Sofu Lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Ribbono Shel Olam knew that they're going to come back and talk Lashon Hara. Why? Also, what should they have learned from Miriam? Miriam was talking about a person. She got tzaraat for talking about another human being. Who's ever heard of Lashon Hara about an object? And this is what they're punished for. They're punished for talking Lashon Hara. They're not punished for inciting the people. They're not punished for discouraging the people. They're punished for talking Lashon Hara about who? A country. Unbelievable thing. Not only that, 600,000 people have their life's ambition removed from all possibility because 10 people talk Lashon Hara about a country. And that, says the Midrash, they should have learned from Miriam that they weren't allowed to. It was a difficult thing to expect a person to learn from Miriam. Also, one has to understand what the purpose of the shlichus was, what they wanted out of these spies. And God was going to lead them into the country. God was their commander-in-chief. What do they need spies for? And also, was God in favor of this or not? It says, Shlach lecha anashim, you send people, says Rashi, l'da'atcha, on your own account. Ani eni metzav elecha, I'm not instructing you to do so. If you say shlach, if you want to, you can send, because the people demanded it. This is also very strange. The people demand something, God knows they're going to talk Loshon Hara. The result of them talking Loshon Hara is that 600,000 people aren't going to be allowed into the land of Israel, and he lets them go ahead with it. It's not fair. And Moshe lets them go ahead with it. Let's look at it. If it was wrong to send these people, why weren't they stopped by Moshe? It's his job. He's their rabbi. If they want to do something which is not in accordance with Torah, he has to say no. So he doesn't. He passes it on to God. So God says, if they want to, let them do it. Both of them knowing that this is going to turn out wrong. And God picks the people. Moshe, with the approval of God, picks out each single man. And they still know it's going to turn out wrong, and they still let them go forward. Some of the Mephoshim, although this is a Gemara which Rashi brings, some of the Mephoshim say it's not so, that Shlach Lecha Anashim is a tzivah, it's a mitzvah. There are many other mitzvahs that also use the word Lecha, Kach Lecha, Egel, Ben Bakar, etc. There are many cases where the Torah uses the word Lecha, take for yourself. And do you have another one? Lulav Netrog, I think, says also Kach Lecha. Lech Lecha. Also, there are many cases where the Torah specifies Lecha, and it doesn't mean do it on your own accord. It's a mitzvah, it's a tzivu, you've got to do it. And many of the Mephoshim, despite this Gemara, they get around the Gemara in other ways, say this is a tzivu, God is instructing you have to do it. One way or the other, is this right or is it wrong? Was it right to send men or was it wrong? If it was right, then the whole thing is funny why it was right. If God knew it was going to turn out bad, and if it was wrong, he should have stopped them. What's the purpose? Let's start with that. What was the purpose of sending the Meraglim? Says God, Shalach lecha anashim, send for yourself men, v'yaturu et eretz Canaan, and they must spy out the land of Canaan. The Hebrew word used is yaturu. Where else do we find the word v'yaturu? Not aturu, at the end of the Zetra, in the Pasha of Tzitzis. So I didn't know what this means, v'yaturu et eretz. It doesn't come very often in the Torah. There are a few times where it comes, but mostly in this Sedra. One of the times it comes is in a different connection altogether, in the Parsha of Tzitzis. It was funny, I started preparing the shiur before I'd read over the Sedra. And I thought to myself, Taturu, that's in the Parsha of Tzitzis now. Where on earth is the last paragraph of Tzitzis? And I said, wouldn't it be funny if it's in the same Sedra? So I started going through and got to the end, and there it was. And I don't think it's coincidental. I think there's a connection between this in this very word. I think connects the end of the Sedra with the beginning of the Sedra. And it's not my vote. Rashi says it. It says, "Velo taturu acharei levavchem v'acharei enechem," so that you don't wander after your heart and after your eyes. Says Rashi the following: "Velo taturu acharei levavchem." What does this word mean? That you mustn't wander after your heart and your eyes? Kemo mitur haaretz. It's the same word used earlier in the Sedra, which means from exploring the land. Says Rashi, "Halev v'ha'inayim heim meraglim laguf." The heart and the eyes are spies of the body. And they are the shatchan. They present the averas to the body. The eye sees, the heart desires, and then the body does it. It's very simple. One can know about averas theoretically, but it's the eye which projects beyond your present situation, enables you to see, enables you to involve yourself in things beyond you. As a result of that, halev chomeid, the heart wants, or put it this way, the eyes of the spies, they project beyond you, and they can see much further than your own existence. And they see nice things all over the place, but you've got to get the body to go there. You can see a nice place, but to get up and go and pack your cases and get there, that's something which is difficult. And you know that the guf is the sitra achra. The guf is the part of you that likes to stay where it is, doesn't like moving around, doesn't like to get off its backside and do something. So you need the lev in the middle. It's the heart which connects the two. The heart chameh, the heart desires. Once there's desire, then the body is prepared to move already. Once there's a bit of taiva, once there's a bit of yetzer, it's a bit of desire, then you can get the body to function. So it's high. Nine go in, the eyes spy out. When they see something nice, they get the heart to want it. And when the heart wants it, the body is prepared to move. That's the connection between that and spying out the land. It's the same thing, I think. This is the essence of it all. What he says is, go and do for Klal Yisrael what the eyes and the heart do for the body. In the same way as the eyes and the heart excite the body about something which is beyond their recognition, something which is beyond their immediate environment, so the eyes are able to penetrate into something further than the individual, and in fact by use of the heart they're able to excite you into action. So these people are a bit schmuffedic. They've got to fight wars, they've got to get into the country, they've got to conquer, they've got to fight. You be the eyes and the heart. You go along there, get yourselves excited about the land, and come back and sell it to these people. Come back, and when you can come back and say, we saw it, it was wonderful, fantastic, let's get going, let's get there as quickly as we can. He wanted them to stir them up a little bit. He wanted them to do with Eretz Yisrael for the Jewish people what the eyes and the heart do with Averas for the body. That's the definition of the word Yaturu. Right? Once that's their purpose in going, that's the purpose in sending them. Sorry, before that, and that makes sense also what Moshe tells them to do. He says, go and have a look at the land and the people living in it. Are they strong or weak? Are they many or few? Whether the people are strong or weak is not a question of whether they're strong or weak and therefore whether it's going to be hard or easy for us. We know it's going to be easy for us because God's sending us in there. That's not the question at all. But if they're a strong people, it's a sign that the land is good. So what I want you to do, says Moshe, is go in and check how good the land is, that you can come back and really sell this land to the people. What kind of land it is? Is it good? Is it bad? The cities, are they fortified or are they open? Is it a fat land or a thin land? Does it have trees? Come back, get a picture of the land and come back and present it. Says the Medrash, Afal pi sha'amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu shalach lecha, even though the Ribbono Shel Olam said, you send the people, lo haya min HaKadosh Baruch Hu sheyelchu, it didn't start with the Ribbono Shel Olam that they should go. It wasn't his idea. He instructed them to go, but it wasn't his idea. And this is my question. Okay, it wasn't his idea, it was their idea, but was it a good idea or a bad idea? It must have been a bad idea, because it says, the Medrash says that the Ribbono Shel Olam knew what was ultimately going to happen. If he knew what was ultimately going to happen, why did he allow them to go? Lama shekvar omer lehen HaKadosh Baruch Hu shvach asher Eretz Yisrael. God had already told them it's a wonderful land. What do they need to go and have a look for it for themselves for? So the Midrash brings an example. Rabbi Yeshua omer, Rabbi Yeshua says, Lama yudomin, what is it compared to? Lamelech shezimen livno ishonoi, a king who prepared for his son Shidduch with a very attractive lady, Uvat Tovim, from a very good family, the Ashiran, she's a rich as well. Amale HaMelech said the king to his son, Zimanti lecha isha noya bat tovim ba'ashiro. My son, I've organized a shidduch for you. She's the most beautiful woman you'll find anywhere. She comes from a wonderful family. She's wealthy. It's just the girl for you. Amale HaBen says the son, Elech be'ereata shiloya amamin lo. He says, oh, let me go and see her. And he said it with an air of, I've got to check up that it's takaso. It's difficult with us because the concept of shidduch like this is something which is not an everyday occurrence by us, and I don't want to go into discussing that at the moment. But a more current example would be if I said to you, I want to give you a present. I've got a house that I want to give you. It's a new house. It's very beautiful. It's 10 rooms. Very easy to keep up. It's in a good neighborhood, a good area. No problems. It's a beautiful house. And you say, would you mind if I go and look at it first? Can I go and check up? What does the Ribbono Shel Olam say? All of a sudden it became very difficult and the father became upset. Omar Aviv said, the father, what can I do now? If I tell him now, I won't show it to you, you can't go and look at the house. Then he's going to say, obviously she's ugly, that's why my father doesn't want to show it to me. In the end he said to him, Re'eyota, go and have a look at it. V'teida, but name, v'teida im kizavti l'chon, see whether I've been lying to you. V'shvil shelo he'amanta bi, but because you didn't believe in me. Konam she'en ata re'eyota b'beitecha. Ela levincha ani nesna. I swear that you won't see her in your home. I'll give her to your son one day. I'm not going to let you marry this girl. The situation with the Klal Yisrael is exactly so. A slight difference. The Ribbono Shel Olam says, I have this wonderful land for you, and describes the beauty of the land. They say, let me see. Once they've said, let me see, there's nothing that God can do but let them see. Because if he says no, they've got to fight wars now. They've got to be excited, and they've got to be determined, and they've got to be interested in what they're doing. Until the end of the 40 years, or it wasn't going to be 40 years at this stage, they were living on a miraculous sort of level. They didn't have to do terribly much. It was all done for them. But once they came into Eretz Yisrael, that mode of existence changed into one of effort and energy. They had to do things themselves. God helping, and God always in the background, and leading them and showing them. But they had to do it themselves. To fight a war and to really conquer a land, such a small nation, conquering several other nations in one go, you had to know what you're doing, and you had to be determined to do it. You couldn't do it half-heartedly. Since the Ribbono Shel Olam, they've asked to see the land. If I don't show it to them, they'll think I've been lying. They'll think that I've been exaggerating. It isn't as beautiful as I told them to. And they're going to lose heart. They're not going to be able to survive in these wars. So I have no choice but to show it to them. The problem is that they asked. But once they asked, it's a mitzvah to show them. But this is a strange, anomalous sort of situation, which occurs a couple of times in the Torah, but this is the one of the most extreme examples. Where it shouldn't be, it should never have got to the stage, but now that it's there, there is no option but to go ahead with it. It's something they brought about all by themselves by asking for it. And the Ribbono Shel Olam finds himself in a situation where he has to say, okay, you can go and have a look at it. But what's so terrible? Why won't you let the leaven live there? Here one sees the problem in their initial request. Intellectually they know it's a wonderful land, Eretz Yisrael, the Ribbono Shel Olam is taking us to there. They've read about it, they've heard about it, they've learnt about it. But you can't get excited about something that you haven't seen. As we learn at the end of the Sedra. It's the eyes which really involve the heart, which involves the body. They're going to have to start involving their bodies. Up till now they didn't have to involve their bodies. Everything was done for them miraculously. Now they're going to have to start involving their bodies. Their question to the Ribbono Shel Olam is a very reasonable one. You want us to involve our bodies for that. We've got to see it. We've got to get excited. Can't get excited about a concept. It's got to be real. The Ribbono Shel Olam says, if it's not real enough by my descriptions, then there's something wrong in our whole relationship. And yes, you've got to go and see it. You're right. You'll never win the war if you don't see it. So I've got to let you see it. But you're not the people who can ever live in that land. Because there's something essential missing. We'll see exactly what it is. And what's that got to do with talking Lashon Hara? But the Medrash says that he knows, that God knows this is going to result in them talking Lashon Hara. There's nothing that stands before the will, before Rotzon, desire. If you want to do something, you can do it. And it's not just by your own efforts. The English statement that where there's a will, there's a way is not really correct. It is correct, but not for the reason of the English statement. We say, "Bederech she'adam rotze leilech molichin osa." The way you want to go, molichin oto, they lead you. Not that they let you go, they actually help you. One criteria. Bederech she'adam rotze leilech, you better want it. If you really want it, you'll get all the siyata dishmaya you need, even if it's wrong. Even if what you want is incorrect, so one has to be careful that one's rotzen is good, that what one wants is good and right. Because if you really want something, even if it's wrong, molichinosa, not only do they let you carry on, but the Ribbono Shel Olam gives you a shove, he helps you along the way, he clears the way in front of you. All you need is rotzen, you've got to really want it. Now rotzen, desire, is an emotion, it's not an intellectual concept. You can't intellectually want something. Intellectually, I've talked about this before, Maharishi Yeshiva used to distinguish between the man who wants to want something and the man who wants it. Wanting to want is an intellectual thing. Everybody wants to be rich. Not many people really want it. Because if they want it, they would do it. If wanting means that even after you've balanced up the effort it requires, the mesuas nefesh it requires, the total involvement it requires, everything else you have to sacrifice for the next 15 years until you get there, if after that you still want it, that's rotzen. Wanting to want is what you're really saying is, if I could get it without the effort, I would like it. It would be good. And that's what most people are living in, that kind of state. That everything they want, they would want without the effort. But a real burning desire that very few people have for anything. When Mark said a little bit earlier about the fact that a dream can be as real or even more real than real life, that's what we're talking about. Because nothing's really important in real life. It doesn't matter. A rotzen makes you take on irrational and enormous ambitions. It always amazes me that I can see my two dogs playing on the lawn as friends, and you put down not one dish of food, but you put down two dishes of food, and they still fight. If they're hungry. What's it all about? When there's hunger, hunger is an emotion, and when there's a desire like that, when there's a need for food as deep as that, you behave irrationally, even an animal does. And then I thought to myself, but it's not only the dogs on the lawn, human beings are exactly the same. How many partnerships don't break up over money? How many marriages don't break up over money? How many friendships don't break up over money? If you look at, I don't know what percentage, but a huge percentage of them, the arguments are nearly always over money. When there's a rotzen, when there's a burning desire, particularly with ambitious people, when there's a burning desire, it doesn't work. Our business, our company has a policy that they very seldom go into partnerships, and when they do, not with friends. Because the friendship is more valuable than the partnership, and both very rarely survive. That's how it is. When it comes to two people aiming for the same pot of gold, friendships go aside, and people behave irrationally and do things they would never normally do because of that thirst. Imagine yourself in a situation, if you can, of extreme thirst. You're in a desert, and you've gone without water, and you're in your last hours of your life. What would you only do for water? Anything. Not stand on your head. You would do much more ridiculous things than that. You would do things you would never think of doing in a normal, sane, ordinary life. And if a person asked you to paint your face red and to walk up and down Elof Street singing Sorry Beret, you would do it with the greatest of joy. It wouldn't make any difference. Why? Rotzen. There's something deep inside you that needs that water, and you'll do anything for it. And when a man is in love, the same. He'll do anything. He'll do all sorts of ridiculous things, and he'll take on all sorts of exercises and ideas to achieve what he's after. Why? Because it's a deep emotional need. It's not a mental need. It's something that's really there. He wants it. He needs it. Am Yisrael understand this principle, that there has to be rotzen. They're going to have to want this land. And in order to want it, their eyes must see it. So they want spies to do what the heart and the eyes do in the case of an Aveira. The Ribbono Shel Olam says that means their relationship with me is an intellectual one. That means as much as I describe it to them, it's still just a concept. It's not enough for them to really want it. They need to go and see it to really want it. Means their relationship with me is not a strong one. One can be presented with all sorts of fantastic challenges. And the only element, sure, there's a degree of physical ability. One can't take on something which is totally beyond one physically. Although I'm not even sure about that, but let's assume that there's to be a certain physical compatibility. But we don't achieve anywhere near our potential in terms of physical or mental exertion. That means challenges can be put before us of which we are capable mentally and physically, and we turn them down. We believe we can't handle them. And the reason that we can't handle them is there's not enough rotzen. To climb Everest, I'm sure it's difficult, and I'm sure it needs a lot of Mesiras Nefesh, but I don't think there's anybody here who couldn't do it. If he really wanted to, so he would train a year, and Mark over there, we would train him for a couple of years if necessary. He would get to a stage where he had the physical ability. If he had the rocks on, if it was absolutely essential for him to climb Everest, he would climb. Yet all of us here don't even consider that as a possibility. It's not even an ambition. We're not thinking of that in those lines at all. We're not thinking Everest. That's climb the Drakensberg. That's about as big as we go in terms of climbing. It just doesn't come into it. And likewise in spiritual areas, in material areas. To start an Anglo-American corporation, that's for Ernest Oppenheimer, not for us. What's the difference? Ernest Oppenheimer was cleverer than us. He was richer than us. He wasn't. Not cleverer than us and not richer than us. He had less than we have when he started, and he wasn't as clever as any of us. What did he have? Rotzen. It had to be done. And he did it. And anything we chose to do as big, any one of us could achieve. If there was rotzen. There isn't rotzen. We don't need anything. It's too comfortable. But there's another funny thing about people. A massive challenge is put before you. You look at this mountain of a challenge and you say, can't get there. What's the next thing you do? You can't say, I'm a failure. You've got to say, what's the point? What's it all about? Everest. There are more important things to do in life than climb Everest. You drag it down. You've got to pull it down. Because if we had the spiritual stature to be able to face the fact that we're not prepared to climb Everest, we would have the spiritual stature to climb it. So either way, if we're not climbing, it's because we lack spiritual stature. And if we lack spiritual stature, there's only one thing left for us to do, and that's to denigrate the big thing. It's not so big, not so important. Says the Ribbono Shel Olam about these people. They need to go and look at the land. Why? Because they're not motivated by an Ahavas Hashem. They're not in love with the Ribbono Shel Olam. If they were in love with the Ribbono Shel Olam and they would walk down Elof Street with their faces painted red, they would conquer the land. If they were really in love. And one must go and see this film, which is a classic Greek film, and quite a kosher film to see, which is, what's it called? We were talking about it later. Iphigenia. Where you see what a whole country did, and this is true history, what a whole country did for one woman. Right? The number of people that died in a war for, I don't remember how many years, for years and years, that had no other motivation for it but the relationship between one man and one woman. To go and conquer a land for the Ribbono Shel Olam shouldn't be difficult, if you're in love with the Ribbono Shel Olam. But if you're not, it's very difficult. Says the Ribbono Shel Olam, so they're not in love with me. So what's going to happen when they see Eretz Israel? It's a very nice country. It's too big for us. What do we need it for? The next thing, when they say it's too big for us, they can't come back to Am Yisrael and say, you know, we're not strong enough to make that land. They're going to have to start denigrating the land. So the Ribbono Shel Olam foresees that people who set off on such a mission are going to have to land up talking Lashon Hara. And let's see what actually happens. So off they go. And they come back. And they start reporting back. We came to the land to which you sent us. It's definitely a land flowing of milk and honey, and here is its fruit. Nothing wrong so far. They stopped there, that would have been fine. But the people are strong. The people who are living in the land are strong. The cities are fortified and very big. We also saw children of the giants there. This is a big people. Also all right. They're reporting facts. They were sent to find out. They're reporting what they saw. Amalek Yoshev Be'eretz HaNegev. Amalek lives in the south. V'achiti v'ayavusi v'amari Yoshev Pahar. They live in the mountains. V'aknani Yoshev Alayam. The Knanim live on the sea. Al-Yad Ha-Yarden on the side of the Jordan. At this point, Kalev starts discerning despair in the people. But they've said nothing wrong yet. Right? So it's not a nice report. They could have tempered it a little bit. But they wouldn't have been punished for it. They were punished for Lashon Hara. There's no Lashon Hara yet. They're performing their duty so far. The people start getting upset with Moshe. Vayas Kalev et Aimel Moshe. And the people, and Kalev tried to pacify the attitude of the people to Moshe. Vayomer, and he said, Alo na'ale v'yarashno otam. Doesn't matter. We'll succeed. We'll make it. He's mad, Kalev. Yeah, but mad people are the ones that achieve. He's madly in love. He's Meshuggah. 600,000 old people with beards have been slaves, who are not strong, who haven't learned warfare. They're going to take on these giants. He's crazy. But that's the only way you can conquer a land, is by being crazy. Ki yachol nuchala, we'll make it, don't worry, everything's alright. Anashim asher alu imamru, and the men who went with him said, lo nuchala lotala. We cannot make it. Ki chazaku limenu, they're too strong, work it out. Look at the statistics, we can't do it. They're also right. Kalev is right and they are right. There's still nothing wrong. Okay, as educators, they're not being very clever. But they weren't appointed as educators. True, they were appointed to sell the land. But they honestly feel they can't do an honest salesmanship job. They honestly feel that this is they're not going to succeed. The next possible then comes that they stopped there, it would still have been alright. So they've expressed an opinion. There's a difference of opinion between Kalev and the other 10. They would have asked Moshe, they would have asked the Ribbono Shel Olam, they would have voted, they could have done everything. There's a difference of opinion which is legitimate. But then they talked Lashon Hara about the land which they explored, El Bnei Israel, and to the people of Israel, saying, that land that we went to have a look at, it eats up its inhabitants. It's so difficult to keep that land. It requires such effort and such energy. The people are so massive physically that you've got to do nothing but look after the land. You won't have any time to learn. You won't be able to keep Shabbos. You won't be able to keep Kashrus. It's not a place for a Jew. That's what he tells them. That's the Lashon Hara. It's a denigration of something which is too big for you. It's too big for you to handle. So what do you have to say? Not only can't we make it, but even if we did make it, it wouldn't be worthwhile. So why bother? It makes a holy mission out of their not taking the land. Shem Shemayim, we can't have. If we want to carry on practicing Yiddishkeit, that land's not for us. And it's for that they're punished, only for that last sentence, because further on it says, as you see here, the only time that it calls it Dibar, the only time that it calls it Loshon Hara is in the last sentence. And further on, Va'anashim, when it talks about the punishment in chapter Yudalud, verse Lamed Vav, and the men who Moshe sent to spy out the land, and who came back complaining about it, talking Loshon Hara about the land, and they died, those men who had talked Loshon Hara about the land in a plague before God. So they died. The only thing that's held against them is that last sentence denigrating the land. Up till then, okay, it's not what it should have been, all the rest of it, but they wouldn't have suffered this fate. They might have been punished for not presenting it nicely, they might have been punished for not fulfilling their mission, for lack of trust in God, all the rest of it. But for Loshon Hara, they wouldn't have been punished until the end. So what's wrong with these people? A lack of an emotional relationship with Ribbono Shel Olam. And it's interesting, the Klei Yaakov says something which is very bold, and I don't know how he says it and where he gets it from. And if it wasn't him, it's a thing that it's only his authority. He says, when it says Shlach Lecha, send on your own account, that goes on the word Anashim, the men. Because I, says God, would rather send women. The Klei Yaakov says. But you, Moshe, think rather men should go? Okay, let the men go, but you're going to have trouble. It's all about. So he says, the Klei Yaakov says, because I know, we won't get into how he proves it. God says, I know the women love the land. The men don't. What it is the essential problem is a lack of a relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam. They're not in love with God, so they're not prepared to do something meshuggah. There's no question it's meshuggah to try and conquer this land. But the trouble with all of us is that we're not prepared to take on anything meshuggah. That was the trouble with them as well. They weren't prepared to take on anything meshuggah, because to take on something meshuggah, you have to have a thirst. You have to be sore inside. You have to need it. And they didn't need it so badly. With the women, it wasn't so. They did have an emotional relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam. The women are more emotional, and they were able to relate to God on a more emotional level. And if God said, go and do it, they would do it. That's it. They would spy it out. They would come back and they would encourage the people. Women are more meshuggah in that way. They're prepared to look at crazy ideas, and that's why they actually need a man to bring them down to ground sometimes. But the idea of thinking of a really crazy meshuggah idea, a woman would do that. Says the Ribbono Shel Olam, this is an incredible thing of the Klei Yaakov. I would rather send women, Shlach Lecha Anashim. If you're sending men, you bear the consequences. That's okay, but it's on your account. The only question that remains now is, how is it possible that they didn't have an emotional relationship with God? If they didn't, how can we? The people who they saw the 10 plagues, the Ribbono Shel Olam took them out personally from Eretz Mitzrayim. They stood on the Yam Suf and they were in a situation of total desperation. God splits the sea, gets them across, kills all the Egyptians. They need water, he finds them water. They need food, he finds them food. The Torah, they heard God talking. Ani Hashem Elokeichem, I am the Lord your God. They heard it word for word. How can they not have an emotional relationship with God? You know why they didn't have an emotional relationship with God? Because emotion is a spiritual concept. It's a quality, not a quantity. And a quality you don't get from receiving, you get from giving. And they had lived in the existence of receiving for years and years. In Egypt, they didn't have to do anything for themselves. They were slaves, so they were fed, they were given whatever they needed. And since Egypt, they haven't had to do anything for themselves. They've been living miraculously. The concept of a miraculous existence is that you're the chetzer. The Ribbono Shel Olam hands out to you. And everything's been handed out to them. You don't develop an emotional relationship by receiving unless you're a woman. A woman is able to develop an emotional relationship by receiving, and that's why God says, I want to send the women. They have a love relationship with me because they've been receiving, but out of a receiving relationship, a woman can develop love. A man can't develop love out of receiving. He has to give to develop love, and they don't love me, these men. And if they don't love me, they're not going to undertake something meshuggah. They're not going to undertake something as crazy as the conquest of this powerful land. We discussed already the difference between, or if you want to ever know whether a concept or whether a feeling is physical or spiritual, whether it's quantitative or qualitative, what you have to do is simply see whether it's enriched by giving it away or it's enriched by keeping it. It's like with light. You can have a candle, one candle burning in a dark room, and if from that candle you light 10 other candles, there's 10 times as much light around without anything suffering. Because that's the candle is energy, the light is energy, the light is a spiritual concept, it's a qualitative thing, and the more you give, the more there is. But if you take the candles out of the room, one by one, the candle itself is a physical thing. If you take the candles out, there's less. So if you want to see whether you're handling the physical part of the candle or the spiritual part of the candle, you just have to see whether you're creating more light or less light. And it's the same with anything else. If by giving it you feel empty, it's quantitative to start with. If by giving it you feel full, it's qualitative to start with. That is the test of whether you're living on a spiritual plane, on a qualitative plane, or on a quantitative plane. They had been receiving all the time. Receiving, as dramatic as it had been, and as personal as it had been, they'd seen the Ribbono Shel personally, they didn't love him. They were unable to establish a love relationship with God. And as a result of that, they were unable to relate to the concept of Eretz Yisrael properly. It started off with their inability to go crazy about the idea of conquering the land without seeing it. Then when they saw it, they were overwhelmed by the power of the challenge and they couldn't face up to it because they weren't in love. And in fact, the Maharal says just that. The Maharal says the reason that they weren't from the beginning, that ab initio something was wrong with the way they did it, is not, as I said, by the fact that they wanted to. The fact that they asked to go and see the land, that showed that there was something wrong. The Maharal says the essential problem was the fact that they'd lived on miracles. That's all he says. But it makes good sense now. They'd lived on miracles, therefore they asked to see the land. Therefore, when they saw it, they had to be scared of it. Having been scared of it, they had to talk Lashon Hora in order to denigrate the land so as to make themselves come out of it okay. This is talking about a land, not about people, but about a land. 600,000 people suffered just about the most miserable punishment you can possibly imagine. It's made impossible for them to achieve what they set out to achieve. Their life is wasted. Except for their children, that they will at least get their children into Israel. But for themselves, their life can be written off. It's the most horrible punishment that there is. Why? Because 10 people spoke Lashon Hora about a land. In one sentence, they just lowered its stature. The two things that I've heard complained about our group, I've never been able to work the connection between the two of them. The one we've often spoken about, and that is the lack of interpersonal involvement. The other is, I'm told, you can check me up if I'm right or wrong, that when we get together, the vast majority of our conversation is about other people. Each other. It makes good sense. To penetrate into the thoughts and needs of another person is a mountainous task. I think I've mentioned to one of you that after the Lubavitcher Rebbe's last heart attack, he went around with one of these electrocardiogram machines, and they were watching to see that he shouldn't exert himself. And whatever he did didn't strain his heart at all. It didn't register any movement, any unusual movement in his heart. It was davening, it was fine, it was learning, it was fine. He went without sleep at night, didn't bother him. He gave a shiur, it was fine, and he shiured him a 4 or 5 hour marathons. No problem, he's talking to thousands of people without a microphone sometimes. No problem, no exertion, everything fine. He sits down to answer a person's letter and the thing goes up and down. So it's to see, to talk to a person, the thing goes up and down. There's nothing more challenging and more difficult and more demanding on a person than to conquer another person, to get inside him, to climb into his needs, to show warmth to him, to work out what he needs, what he wants, how to help him, to care for him. To care for another human being is the most demanding and difficult thing there is. There's nothing more difficult. To pretend to care is easy. To show a face of caring is easy, but to really care, there's nothing that's more difficult than that. If you can't, if the job is too big for you, you won't say you can't. Because the size of a challenge you can accept depends on your inner resources, as I said a few minutes ago. If you have the inner resources, you can accept any challenge. If you don't, you can't. the thing that limits you is your inner resources. Hilton, correct me if I'm wrong, when you're running on that Comrades Marathon, no? Everybody who's running can physically make it. It's a question of, have you really got the inner resources to get there? Yeah, assuming that you're okay. And I think that even if you can't face that challenge, there's only one thing left for you to do. You've got to pull the other guy down. He's not really worth the effort in any case. He's just an ordinary guy after all. Just like everybody else. To deprive other people of their specialness is a natural consequence of not being able to relate to them. You must do it. There's no way, if you're a man of quality, there's no way you can face yourself not handling the other guy without talking Lashon Hara. And Lashon Hara is subtle, as you see. All it is an intimation to yourself that it isn't really worth it. So you'll get into him. So you'll help him. So what? What's going to change? What's going to be achieved by it? Just something to make it not worthwhile putting in the effort. That's what Lashon Hara is. As you're learning Psochim, you'll remember right in the beginning there's a Gemara also where there's talk about a man went out to see the crops, the wheat crops, and was asked when he came back, how are they? And the Gemara said, what he should have answered is, last year they were good. And so you don't say they're bad. It just denigrates it a little bit. It's not necessary to say that. We go out of our way not to denigrate, to retain the specialness in other situations. Don't bring everything down to your level. Leave them up there. Leave them special. Have something to climb up towards. And if you can't climb up, then still leave them there. Don't try and remove Mount Everest because it bothers you. Leave it there. It's a beautiful sight, even if you can't make it yet. Develop the stature, the ability to be able to make it someday in the future, but don't remove it. And this is something that there's a tremendous tendency to do in the Western world. I don't know, it's probably prompted by the whole socialist and communistic approach of trying to pull everything down to the lowest common denominator of human ability. Since all men are equal, what you've got to do, you can't bring the fools up to the level of the geniuses, so you've got to bring everybody down to the level of the fools to make them all equal. You can't bring the poor up to the level of the rich, so you must bring the rich down to the level of the poor. That's the only way you can do it. It's reducing everything to its lowest common denominator. And we're living in a world now where this is a predominant pressure to bring everything down to equality. And it's not something which we tolerate in Torah. Each person has a specialness, each person has a uniqueness. And each situation has a specialness and a uniqueness. And every situation demands from you, if you want to handle it right, the most incredible effort and the most incredible challenge. And to achieve it or not to achieve it is a question of inner resources. Those inner resources come from a relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam. You've got to want it. So that's what it's all about. When you're in love, you can do things that you can't do when you're not in love. When you're thirsty, you'll fight for water like you don't fight when you're not thirsty. When you're ambitious, in the sense that we're talking, you'll achieve things that you won't achieve when you're not ambitious. That's a question of developing an Ahavas Hashem. That's all it really is. If you relate to another person, and this is the fallacy of the humanistic claim, that you can be a good man-to-man relationship person without being a good man-to-God relationship person. You can't. Because on a man-to-man relationship, as soon as the man is too big for you to handle, you have to give it up. What's going to make you carry on with it? Unless it's someone you're in love with, which can be one or two people, how many people can that be? So if you're not in love with a person, how can you possibly develop the inner resources to be moser nefesh, to really give your life to sort out that other person's problems? How can you do it? The only way you can do it, you've got to be in love with someone. And if you're not in love with a person, then at least you've got to be in love with the God who tells you to do it. You're doing it for him. In the same way as if you're in love with so-and-so, and he or she tells you to do something, you do it as part of your love relationship with them. And you might relate to a third person in a special way just because your beloved one asks you to do so. So when the Ribbono Shel Olam, with whom you have a love relationship, hopefully, says, I don't care what it costs you, I want you to climb into that person and to help them, it's part of your love relationship with God which enables you to do it, which enables you to give your life to do it. But if you don't have that love relationship with God, you can forget about being a good human being. There's no way you can have that kind of mesiras nefesh, that kind of dedication. And as we said, the problem with these people in their not having this love relationship was because they'd been recipients, they'd been receivers. The love relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam can only be achieved through giving to him. And one has to understand that the giving has to be on a qualitative level too. It's not enough to come to a minyan. It's not enough to make a minyan even. Yeah, sure, that's a little bit of giving, but it's still quantitative giving. You've got to make the Ribbono Shel Olam smile at the end of your davening. He should feel good. He should feel that somebody's made his day for him. He should feel happy. when you stand up and say Kiddush, it's not just that he's instructed you to say Kiddush, so you say Kiddush. You should have in mind, you should picture the change in the Rabbeinu Shalom's expression as he watches you making Kiddush. And if you can't change his expression, you're not giving to him. You're not giving him nachas, you're not making him happy. It's the same as your beloved one asks you to do something and you do it like you do everything else. If he or she doesn't show pleasure, it means that you haven't pleased them, although you did what they wanted you to do. There's a way that it has to be done. There's a quality of love and dedication and beauty that has to be put into it to make it worthwhile to the beloved one. And so it is to develop this relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam that we're talking about, to develop this love relationship which is now the essence of everything else we do, it becomes necessary to give to him and to start the thing working on a basis that ultimately one's able to feel him and to relate to him. I want to say, and as an example of this situation, is the challenge that our friend, the resident Kohen over here, faces this week of going into the army. It's a challenge too, like the challenge, not quite the same, but not terribly different to the challenge that Klal Yisrael faced then. In the sense too, that it's big. Going in for 2 years, you're going to be relating to not your type of person, in not your type of situation. Things are going to be demanded of you that is not your type of thing. And altogether, you have one of two things. You can go in and become a machine, become totally insensitive to everything. That's the way most people survive. If you don't want to do it that way, then you've got to talk Lashon Hara. Yeah, the army, it's not particularly important. I don't believe in what I'm doing. I don't believe in this country. And make yourself and everybody else miserable. Denigrate it to make it clear that the fact that you're going to come out of it a worse person is not your fault, it's their fault. That's the second way of doing it. That appeases your conscience. You come out having wasted 2 years, and you can say it's the South African government's fault, it's not my fault. The third way is to make sure that you don't waste 2 years. The third way is to make sure that you see that the Ribbono Shel Olam doesn't put you in a situation unless he wants something from you. He could have got you out of the army. He didn't. If he didn't, then he wants you to achieve something in the army. He has a function for you, he has a purpose for you. And that purpose can be manifold. The one thing I always tell people going into the army is that you should know that if you have the schus to kill a terrorist or two, it's a big mitzvah. And don't feel bad about it. And there's nothing to worry about. And you should go into it with that mishugas that Am Yisrael had to go into there. You should know that you should go into it with an Avas Yisrael, because you don't know what Jew or non-Jew or who that terrorist can get to if you don't get to him first. You have a chiyuv, you have an obligation, al pi Torah, without any question, to get rid of any of them you can. And if you're not in the front lines, but you're assisting people who are in the front lines, directly or indirectly, you should have that same understanding that you're performing a mitzvah as important as any other mitzvah you're going to do at any time in your life, in making sure that and the people who are at the front are able to perform their duties efficiently and are able to get on with their job of protecting the rest of us. The chiyuv has got nothing to do with whether these terrorists believe in what they're doing or they don't believe in what they're doing. It's got nothing to do with that. A snake is a cute little animal, and yet it's a mitzvah to kill a snake that's in a human habitated area. Not because we have anything against the state snake, but if you don't kill him, he'll kill someone. So it's part of your man-man relationship, it's part of your Avas Yisrael and Avas Habrius, your love of humanity, which is mechayev, you obligates you to kill a snake. And the person who doesn't, because he's a humanist or whatever you call them, Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, he won't kill snakes. Cruelty to animals he does mind, cruelty to human beings he doesn't mind. One has to be very careful about that. Nebuch the terrorist, but you've got to think of Nebuch the people the terrorist is out to kill. And whatever it involves you in, you should do that with Mesiris Nefesh. You should give yourself clearly during these 2 years to give as much as you can to ensure the safety of the people who are living innocent and straightforward lives in this country. Apart from that, there are other areas that I'm sure the Ribbono Shel Olam wants you to function in, because there are other people who could handle the terrorists, but there are not many other people. You can count them on a couple of hands, the number of people who can encourage the people who are in the army, particularly the Jews, who go in with a sort of a guilt feeling, don't see it tying up with the rest of their lives. And I think that one of the chiyuvim that you'll have is to be an encouragement to other Jewish people, and through your encouragement, not only to help them get through those 2 years in a way that makes them better people and greater people, but that you possibly encourage them to Yiddishkeit. You can do all sorts of incredible things during the 2 years that you have before you. And if you manage to achieve this, as I'm sure you will, you look back on those 2 years not as a waste of time at all, but possibly as the most productive 2 years of your life. The possibility, the potential that lies before you in interpersonal relationships is something magnificent. You have the chiyuv to be a kiddush Hashem, to be an example both among the Jews and the non-Jews. You should also know that the chiyuv to be makariv people is not only to Jews, it's to non-Jews as well. The Rambam paskens that it has to be makariv non-Jews, not to Torah, but to the sheva mitzvahs b'nei Noach. You should encourage them to be straight and moral Jews. And it's going to be difficult, but remember, you need the inner resources for that. If you don't have the inner resources and the inner stature, the tendency is going to be to denigrate the army. And for the inner resources, you will learn and find yourself in a constantly in a giving relationship to the Ribbono Shel. And it's something you should really write out on a piece of paper in your own words and read over every day, just to make sure that you never lose sight of it. Because if one day goes past and you lose sight of it, you can learn, find yourself sliding into a routine which deprives you of all humanity. So we wish you good luck. The strength of character that you've shown over here over the last couple of years and the progress as a mensch is something that leaves me no doubt that you have a very important function to play and that you'll succeed.